song is called Canaan Bound, the music from Andrew Peterson. At 8.5 minutes after the hour, it's a Tuesday morning, and we have on the line none other than Dr. Don Clark. He's our resident biochemist. He's a member of the Board of Creation Moments. And Don, we haven't heard from you in a while. Will I recognize your voice? Let's see.
Well, I've been around.
Oh, yeah.
You're the one who hasn't been around.
That's
true. I missed several weeks there because of bottle filling.
Yeah, you were. Yeah,
at least a couple of weeks there. Then you went off to on vacation. So
that's true.
This is the first opportunity we have to get back together.
Well, and I'm so glad because we've had listeners asking, "Where's Dr. Don? What's wrong with Dr. Don? Where's Dr. Don?" and now he's right here, and everything's just fine. You got some wine bottled there, didn't you?
I mean, we did. Yeah. We've got our Pinot Grigio and our Blanc Dubois bottled. So we've done all the major bottling. Now we've got some smaller batches from last year that we need to bottle, which we'll probably do tomorrow.
Is this the award winner that you're going to bottle some more of?
Well, that was the Blanc Dubois.
The gold medal. You got a gold medal already. Yeah.
We have the Shiraz from last year and our Muscat from last year, which, of course, makes our Moscato, our sweet wine, our only sweet wine, actually. All our other wines are dry, but they don't taste dry sometimes because they're the goal, at least my goal as a winemaker, is to make smooth wine, as smooth as possible.
That's a new name for me, for smooth wine. You think of the harder liquors as being smooth or not smooth, but wine?
Well, I would go along with that. I think you're getting close to having an ideal. We opened the bottle of Blanc de Blanc. Now, I hope that wasn't Jim's bottle.
For those of you new to the broadcast, hold that thought for a second. For those of you new to the broadcast, Dr. Don is part of the leading edge of the Texas wine industry now, with his vineyard in Garden Valley, Texas, about 90 miles kind of northeast of Dallas there. And the name of the winery again is Valle della Pace?
Pace? Yeah, it's Valle della Pace, which means Valley of the Peace.
Oh, we're losing your audio there. We're going to have to get you to boost that up a little bit, too.
I got some important questions.
Yeah,
go ahead. We can't lose them now.
Go ahead. No.
Can you hear me now? Can you hear me?
Just barely.
I think it's an internet problem
barely.
Here.
I'm all the way up.
And your picture is beginning to pixelate. I think your internet company has fallen asleep.
It's on your end. I'll close my camera down. Maybe that'll help.
Okay, I'll do that too.
I'll get the question in quickly. I tried the bottle of Blondie, and it seems that the last bottle of Blondie that I had was more intense. The flavors were a little bit sharper, but at the same time, it also seemed like it wasn't as smooth as this one was. Was that? I mean, it's very difficult to say that you get a pound of this and a pound of that, and you result with this. It's not that. It's more of a sense or a feeling about it that relies on all kinds of other stuff.
What he's trying to say, it's an intuitive wine, Don.
Unless you go to extreme measures, and the grapes are, it's a different year, so you've got a different vintage. This, the 2015 was a little bit riper than the previous year. Well, actually, I mean, the 2013 that you had before. It's a little bit riper. It's going to have slightly different characteristics. We had larger batches to deal with, so you've got issues with that, as opposed to smaller batches that we had before. And you tasted a wine, the 2013 was in the bottle for some time. So this wine, the 2015, will build more character as it's in the bottle. For several more months, it will pick up more flavors and anyway, it'll continue to improve. Is what well,
anyway, this
say.
All comes about because David and I purchased one of the first orders from the Valle della Pace vineyard, and it arrived while I was on vacation, and I'm not sure that my half of the shipment is still there or not, David.
You picked it up. I'll be right back.
Okay, never mind.
Carol, did you put that box away?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm just glad to hear that. I may save that description because, you know, I'll be able to show that to my wine students and people mm-hmm. that I've gone through wine tasting with and say, and tell them, I say, see, I'm not making this up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's actually, did you, I mean, you noticed the difference too then?
Oh yeah, there's a difference between the two. This one, this one is a little lighter than the one back in 2013. There's a number of reasons. It doesn't have as much acid as the 2013 does, mm-hmm. yeah. And you know maybe we had it's difficult also to get the grapes to ripen all at the same time. So you have those that are really exposed to the sun getting ripened very early, and then you got to kind of wait until the ones under the leaves.
So the weather can change the wine from year to year then too, can it?
Oh yeah. I mean, 2013 it was sprinkling when we were picking the grapes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Last year in 2015 it was dry, and this year is going to be dry. I mean, it's kind of dry as a bone right now.
However, we can rest assured that each vintage, the 2013 and the 2015 grape, each had the same DNA, huh?
Well, that is true.
Okay. All right.
Over 400 vines, so they've mm-hmm. got slight differences between the DNA.
Wait a minute. Does the DNA deteriorate? Does it mutate with each generation of grapes, do you think?
Well, it does. There are changes that happen in the DNA, mm-hmm. and it happens obviously in humans as well as all animals, mm-hmm. and it happens in plants as well. So if there wasn't variation that took place in the DNA, then you wouldn't have different varietals of wine, for
mm-hmm.
example.
Mm-hmm. Now, does this mean that, as with human beings, you can measure the number or the rate of mutations and then calculate the original DNA of the wine and have the original vintage recreated? Possibility? DNA research?
Well, yes, DNA research is done all the time on wine, mm-hmm. On specific varietals to see, okay, what was the parentage, for example, of this mm-hmm. particular varietal?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they're fooled because they think it's, you know, one thing, and then another. They do the testing, and it says, nope, it came from over here.
Uh-huh. So that tells where the grape.
So they can not only mm-hmm. tell the parentage, they can tell pretty much where it came from.
Okay. Now, is that the same as mitochondrial DNA?
No.
Okay.
Mitochondrial DNA, plants don't have mitochondria, you know, per se. Mitochondria, or the often referred to in your biology class, is the powerhouse of the cell, because it's responsible for actually generating a compound called ATP, which is adenosine triphosphate,
mm-hmm.
and that's like the chemical activator for all of the chemical reactions in your body. In your cells. So but the mitochondria, here's the interesting thing about the mitochondrial DNA versus your nuclear DNA, which is, you know, in the center of your cell.
Mm-hmm.
The mitochondria are floating out, not floating, but they're in the cellular matrix outside of the nucleus. Now, the mitochondrial DNA, the mitochondria, not just the DNA, but the whole mitochondria, comes from the mother and not from the father.
Uh-huh.
The father contributes the second half, if you will, of the DNA that goes into the nucleus. The mother does too, but the mother also provides the cell, if you mm-hmm. will, to start life.
So it's like you've got a little cell, and it's got all the machinery. It's got all the enzymes. It's got all of the stuff that you need for that cell to grow, but it's missing half of its DNA. We know that, you know, of course, the DNA is a double helix, which means that it's got two pairs of DNA. When a egg is formed, it only has one of the two pairs. And then, of course, when the sperm interacts with that particular egg, then it enters the the egg and enters that that cell ready, you know, which is ready to divide. So as soon as the DNA gets into the nucleus, the sperm or the DNA from the sperm gets into the nucleus of the cell, then the cell starts cell division at that point. But the egg has all the machinery. So it's interesting because I think there was a new Jurassic Park movie that came out, you know, not too long ago. And there's a problem with that because you need, they say that, oh, we used frog eggs in order to, you know, generate all of these dinosaurs. And so there was an egg, but you do need the machinery, if you will, of a cell in order to make another cell, in this case, make mm-hmm. another human being.
Yeah, that was a part of Michael Crichton's book, and that was in the first movie, that they had most of the DNA, but there was chunks had been knocked out or had decayed over time. So they took some frog DNA and kind of patched it in. I don't know that they use specific pieces.
Well, that's how you would get leaping lizards, isn't it?
With teeth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But it was. I've often wondered, does that make scientific sense?
No, it doesn't make scientific sense. Okay. So it was a good attempt to try and say how they made all of these different types of dinosaurs, but. You know, you need more. For example, you need more of the animal than just its DNA. Which is the whole point I'm trying to say is that, you know, the mother, for example, with the egg, provides all of the machinery in the cell. So it's not like when you have, you know, at the point of conception, you just have two DNA molecules getting together. From there, you know, starts life. You need all of the enzymes, you know, DNA cyclase, for example, that actually unwinds the DNA in order to, you know, start the replication process. And, of course, you need an energy source, which is where the mitochondria comes from and why you need mitochondria in order to, you know, to start that process.
Say that it's the female's DNA that rules the roost.
Not necessarily.
Life that is.
It's not the DNA. It's the it's all of the other stuff in the cell.
Okay, I gotcha.
Alrighty. Yeah, so it's all of the other stuff. You know, it's like, let's see, you can have, for example, well, let's use the, you can have a disc that has a video on it, but that disc is not going to do you very much good unless you have a Blu-ray or a DVD player and, you know, the associated monitor and all this other stuff to make it go. So you can look at the egg as all of the other stuff to make it go.
Okay, well, we're kind of wending our way toward an article here posted in the Institute for Creation Research by Brian Thomas. And it's entitled DNA Trends Confirm Noah's Family, and it has to do with mitochondrial DNA, and that's the part that's traced from mother to mother to mother to mother, and it stuns me that they can graph something from this. Explain the graphing, the chart, and what that means, what it tells.
Well, they look for similarities, for example, between the you know, the DNA, the mitochondrial DNA. So, again, the mitochondria itself has DNA because it also replicates as the cells divide and stuff. So you need more mitochondria. So it's got to divide, but it's different from the nuclear DNA, which we normally think of as kind of the information source for the person.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the mitochondrial DNA also gets passed on, from progeny to progeny, and from generation to generation. But as it gets passed on, of course, there's mutations that occur, and so you can track the similarities in the mitochondrial DNA, or in this case the differences, and then you can make a plot as to how similar or different the DNA is, and then from there you might be able to draw some conclusions and as to, okay, this race of people, for example, came from this other race of people, or these two races of people seem to be similar, or they're completely, different from one another.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's in a kind of a graphic format, that's kind of what's going on.
By the way, I'm looking at such a chart, and if you'd like to see it too, you can click the link in our chat window there. It'll take you to the same article at the ICR website, and you can see a picture of this graph, and it's a very short article. It's technical, but it's a short one, and it tells us some stunning stuff here. Explain the essence of the article, Don.
Well, it's actually very poignant article, and it kind of answers a lot of questions and verifies what the Genesis record tells us.
Mm-hmm.
For example, here's the experiment. Dr. Nathaniel Jensen plotted hundreds of human mitochondrial DNA. And we talked about what that was and mm-hmm. how that's different from the nuclear DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And they plotted it on this difference diagram. And lo and behold, as these differences kind of coalesce, if you will, they will, depending on the number of different ancestries, form one, will coalesce into 1 point or 2 points or 3 points or 5 points if there were five mothers that started this whole thing off.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what they found was, there are three. So three moms kind of started all of the differences in the personages, around the world, around the globe. And so you go back and say, why three? Why not one?
No, just to clarify, so all of us, all the human beings on the face of the earth through all the generations could be traced back to its origins with one of three different mothers.
That's correct.
Hmm.
So if, for example, if evolution were true, then that should be one. Everybody should be, should point back to one mom out of the primordial soup, becoming a monkey an ape, and then the ape, eventually turned into a man somehow, from that one woman, came all of the human race.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what was found. Why someone hasn't done this before, is really mind-boggling, because it's a very, now that we have all of this DNA data in databases, you can do these types of plotting and experiments, and then come up and see what your answer is. Well, here they came up and says, well, there's three. Well, if you go back to Genesis, of course, we know that there were eight people who went into the flood. There was Noah and his wife, and then Shem, Ham, and Japheth and their wives. So there were three wives, and all of us are descendants of either Shem, Ham, or Japheth. And so we should expect then, post-flood, that we would all originate from three different mothers. So that data corroborates, for example, exactly what's in the Bible. Now, they went one step further and said, well, we know, for example, that the maximum number of mutations per given time period is this. And so let's see how many differences. So that should give us a maximum number of differences, for example, between these three original moms, for example. And so if you assume that the genealogy in the Bible is correct, and you assume that, well, you know, to the flood, it was about 1,600 years thereabouts, then you should have eight differences between these three moms. And that's exactly what they found.
That's one mutation per generation.
Not necessarily one mutation per generation, but one mutation per certain number of years.
Ah, okay.
And so they found eight, and that's what you would expect for the time between let's say you know, the start of creation, if you will, Adam and Eve, mm-hmm. till Noah, the Noah's flood, and then you know, post flood. So that's what they found. And then they went one step even further and said, well, it looks like, you know, if we take the biblical history as being accurate, then we know it's been about 4,400 years. Since the flood. And so we should have, for example, about 115 mutations in the mitochondrial DNA to the most, different DNA in our little plot here, till now.
Mm-hmm.
And so they went ahead and did that. And they found the number of differences, and it was 115. So actually, well, you have to add the 8 to it from, you know, before. So that would give you 123. And so what they found was it was 123.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't thousands, as you would anticipate, or hundreds of thousands if, there's this millions and millions of years of man's genealogy, but it was 123, which corroborates exactly with a young Earth creation model that you would interpret or basically calculate from the genealogies that's in Genesis.
This is really stunning information, but and so I'm going to challenge you with a question. How would an evolutionist read this article, and at what points would they challenge, do you think? I mean, this looks like a pretty solid argument.
Yeah, well, I mean, even if you challenge the assumptions, so what are the assumptions? The assumptions are that there's X number of mutations, you know, per year or per time period.
Mm-hmm.
So you could challenge that. Well, but that's not empirically measured. It's a measured value. it's of course it's an average value, but it is a logical value. So that's challenging that doesn't really get you very much. I mean, mm-hmm. You can say, well, okay, instead of 8, maybe there's 10. Or at least, you know, or maybe there's 6.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that buys you, you know, some years, either forward or backward, but it doesn't
you know, it's not going to get you to the hundreds of thousands of years that you're looking for from an evolutionary point of view. The other thing that they could challenge you on, I mean, the authors suggested that an average age for a young lady, you know, giving birth would be 15 years of age. Mm-hmm. Now, today we would consider 15 years maybe a little young. But, you know, back then, of course, you know, that was in our past history. That is not an unacceptable age. Matter of fact, it's probably in sometimes it might be a little old.
Mary, they figure, was between 12 and 14, probably.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the young lady is of age to have children for certain, certainly. Mm-hmm. And so it's a conservative number. It's a reasonable number. But if you, you know, if you change that age, then you have different number of genealogies. I mean, different number of progeny or different generations, number of generations for the same time period. You're dealing with, okay, well, instead of maybe 4,400 years, it might have been 5,000 years, or it might have been 4,000 years. So you're not dealing with, you know, big time mm-hmm. time frame differences, and you need, again, you know, thousands of years. So that's not going to do it for you. So you know, on the basis of what these folks have done, everything is reasonable. And of course, you can't get an exact, number, but the numbers are quite reasonable. And even if you fudge them a little bit, you're still in the same general ballpark for a creation model, and mm-hmm. you're way off from an evolutionary model.
And this little chart is rather stunning if you accept it as valid, and the article is convincing that it is valid. Three distinct points they point them out there that represent the changes between the three original mothers of the human race, that is, post-flood. Interesting stuff. It's, again, an article at the Institute of Creation Research. And take you 5 or 10 minutes to read, and you'll chomp on this all day. This is interesting evidence that Genesis is exactly what it says it is. It's a history, and it's factual, and it's true. And it's accurate. And I think you'll find this a neat article to read. The link, again, is in our chat window now at brokenroadradio.com. Well, Dr. Don, good conversation. And I think we learned some things about DNA. And I'd already known that in order to really trace ancestry, you need the mother's DNA to do that. And so that's the mitochondrial thing that you've explained to us rather neatly. And so we're all a step ahead of the game as of this conversation. So thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You're quite welcome. It's been fun as usual.
Mm. And Don, a member of the Board of Creation Moments, creationmoments.com is their website. And at Creation Moments, at the website, you will find volumes of information, scientific information, scientific analysis and findings that supports young earth creationism. And regardless of your beliefs, if you're seriously interested in the topic, you owe it to yourself to peruse that website and take a look at this material and see how it affects or doesn't affect your thinking. It's information that's begging to be known. It does not get wide dispersal, wide dissemination in this culture, which is so heavily kind of reflexively on the side of evolution. There's another argument, and it's scientifically supported. And so, again, if this is of interest to you, if you care whether it's creationism or evolutionism, evolution, then you need to take a look at that creationmoments.com website. You can link to it from ours at Broken Road Radio. Don Clark, it's good to have you back, and we'll look forward to, perhaps another visit next Tuesday, huh?
Well, that should work. We're going to do our first harvest this weekend on Saturday with our mascot from this year. And we have a larger harvest, actually, in all the fields this year. So we're looking forward to
it. Well, and this is not a paid commercial or anything, but it's neat to know you can now order wine from Valle della Pace. I said that right, didn't I?
It's Vella.
Okay.
And valley, which means valley, of course.
And the website, Vella. The website is for the winery.
Valladellapace.com. Uh-huh, that's ValladellaPace.
And if David hasn't consumed my share of the shipment while I was gone, we'll have a complete report for you next week.
All right. Okay. That sounds great. Yeah, let me know what you think.
Don, we will do that. Take care of yourself. Say hello to Andrea for us, and we'll catch you next week. Bye-bye.
Okay. So long.